start with starting a new sefer from the five books, Shmos, and want to say something about the name of the sefer, Shmos, Ve'ele Shmos Bnei Yisrael. All of the books of the Torah have two names. The name that we're most familiar with, Bereishis Shmos, Vayikra, Bamidbar, Dvorim. But there's also a thematic name that the rabbis gave to each of the Svarim. And you may think that you don't know that name, but you do. And I'll tell you what it is first, and I'll tell you why you surely know it. Sefer Bereishis, the rabbis called Sefer Hayitzira, the book of creation. Sefer Shmos, they called Sefer HaGeula, the book of redemption. Vayikra is called Toras Kohanim, the laws of the Kohanim. Bamidbar is called Chumash HaPikudim, the Chumash of the sensei, of counting. Because when they went into the desert, they were counted, and when they left the desert, they were counted. It begins with a count, with a census, and ends with a census. So it's Chumash HaPikudim. And the last one, Devarim, is called Mishneh Torah. Now, you may have never heard those names before, but you did. Because the Greeks, when they named the Chamisha Chumshei Torah, when they were translating to Greek, they used the thematic names that the rabbis had given these books, and not Bereishis, Shmos, or whatever. Therefore, they called the first book Genesis. Genesis means Sefer HaYetzirah, the book of creation. And they called the second book Exodus, which means the redemption. And the third book Leviticus, which means the laws of the Levium and the Kohanim. The Kohanim are Shevet Levi. So Leviticus means the laws of the Levium. And Bamidbar, they called Numbers. If you ever wondered who made the mistake of translating Bamidbar to Numbers, it's not a mistake. It's just that that is the name of Chumash HaPikudim. This is the Chumash of Numbers. Counting when they came in, the counting when they came out. And that's the name the rabbis gave that book, Chumash HaPikudim, Numbers. And Deuteronomy means the review of the law. Anami is the law, and Deuter is the review. So Mishneh Torah. So those are the names. If you think about it, the two names for four of the books seem to be compatible one with the other. Bereishis in the beginning, and Sefer HaYetzirah, the book of creation, fit very nicely together. Vayikra, God called to Moshe, he called to him from the Mishkan to tell him the laws of the Kohanim, so that fits in nicely. Vayikra, what was the Vayikra? Torah's Kohanim. Bamidbar, the desert, what happened in the desert? Everything that happened in the desert happened between the beginning census and the end census. So Bamidbar and Chumash HaPikudim go together. And Eila HaDvarim, these are the words. What were the words? Mishneh Torah, review of the Torah. The only one that doesn't seem to fit is Shmos and Sefer HaGeula. Shmos is names, and Sefer HaGeula is the book of redemption. What's the connection between names and the book of redemption? More than that, there's a medrash that says, Bishchus ve'eila Shmos b'nei Yisrael, Miskaimin ve'eila toldo shamayim va'aretz. In the merit of the names of the Jewish people exist the heavens and earth. Now, I understand the world may exist in the merit of the mitzvahs, the Torah of the Jewish people, but their names? Why does the world exist in the merit of our names? There's also a Rashi in the beginning of the Sedra, the Eila Shmos, that the Jewish people are as precious as the stars. Just like every star God calls by name and counts it, so too the Jewish people are called by name and counted both when they were alive and after death. The Eila Shmos B'nei Yisrael, it appears also in Parshas Vayigash, that we're special, God counts us and calls each one by name just like the stars. Also needs explanation. What is so special that God gives names to every star? Right? It obviously is not what I'm going to tell you now. I usually find myself in the States around this time of year, between Thanksgiving and the next holiday that the Christians observe. And it's a time for gift giving. Okay? And I heard on the radio over the last 25, 30 years the following advertisement. In case you have somebody on your gift list that has everything, which in America was possible, I think, years ago. Today, I'm not sure anymore. But maybe somebody has everything. So what do you give them as a gift? So they said, we have the following suggestion. If you will send, about 25 years ago, it was $25. And last year, I heard it was $75. So it must be a profitable business. The price has gone up. If you'll send $75 to this address, we will name a star for the person that you want to give the gift. We will register it in the star registry, and we will send the person an affidavit that this star is named for him and registered in the star registry. First of all, don't do it. Because you could walk out outside, I didn't look to see if it's a clear night or not, but if it is, you can take a piece of paper, two pieces of paper. On the first piece of paper, write star registry. And then name every star in the heavens for yourself, your family, and anybody else you want for free. And record it on that piece of paper that says star registry. Then write yourself another piece of paper, an affidavit, that you have registered the star on your star registry. That's exactly what they do. They have a booklet that they name Star Registry. Register the star there and send an affidavit that it's registered in the star. You can do that for free to every star in the heavens. You don't have to send $75 anywhere. Right. But it obviously works. And obviously people do this because they pay money for advertising. So, is that what it means? God calls every star by a name and he counts them. Big deal. Now the idea is that the name of something, Adam HaRishon called names to everything in creation. It wasn't just arbitrary names. He decided, well, this looks like a dog, we'll call it a Kelev. But the name itself represents the essence of that thing. Its qualities, its abilities, its capabilities. The name of a person represents his abilities, capabilities, and talents. And that's why the rabbis say that in fact, each and every one of us has four names. And it doesn't necessarily mean the name you're called by per se, even though that also has a connection. But it says there's a name that God gives you. There's a name your parents give you. There's a name your friends give you. And the main name is the one you make for yourself. The idea being the following. Everybody has various talents, abilities, and capabilities. Some of them are part of your original essence, the makeup of your soul. God created each and every one of us to serve a purpose in this world, and he equipped our souls with the personality, with the abilities, capabilities, and talents to be able to fulfill that purpose. Everybody's different. That's the name that God gives you. The abilities, capabilities, and talents that are part of your soul directly from God. Some talents, abilities, and capabilities you get by heredity. That's the name your parents give you. They gave you those talents, abilities, and capabilities through heredity. Some things you don't get from heredity, and you don't get, they're not part of your soul, but they're things you learn from the environment around you. That's the name your friends give you. All of that is potential. Potential is like a zero. If you have a lot of potential, you have a lot of zeros. Still zero. If you put a number in front of those zeros, the more zeros there are, the bigger the number is. The main name is what you make for yourself. What you take that potential and actualize it and realize it. That's the main name that a person has. And if you don't realize or actualize, nothing. But that's what a name is. That's why the Torah later on says, before they built the Mishkan, so the one who was to build the Mishkan was Bezalel. And the Torah says to Moshe Rabbeinu to tell the Jewish people, Re'ei Korasi B'Shem Bezalel. See that I call the name of Bezalel. The Sfarno says whenever it says the word see, re'e, in the Torah, and it doesn't mean to see something tangible with your physical eyes, it means to think, contemplate, ponder, think. So how long can you think about the fact that God called the name of Bezalel? About a second. What is there to think deeply into the fact that God called the name of Bezalel? But the idea is, Bezalel was a very talented young man. He was a builder, an architect, a jeweler, a Kabbalist, a big Talmud Chacham. He had many, many talents in physical, material areas and in spiritual areas. Where did he get those talents from? Went to college. He took a correspondence course. He was a slave his entire life in Egypt. Obviously, those talents, abilities, and capabilities were God-given. Excuse me. They're a present given to him by God. That's the first thing to contemplate. Re'ei Korosi B'Shem, look how talented Bezalel is. Obviously, those talents were given to him as an endowment. He was endowed by God with those talents. First thing to learn from him is that every one of us is endowed with talents, abilities, and maybe not to the extreme that Bezalel had, but everybody has their talents, abilities, and capabilities. That's not necessary. It's not going to help. It's okay. I consider it as if I had it, but now I'm okay. So that is one thing to learn. Everybody is endowed with talents, abilities, and capabilities. Second lesson. Why do you think God endowed Bezalel with those talents? So he could build shopping centers, townhouses, maybe. I don't know what he did in his spare time. But it's very obvious that the reason why God gave him those talents is because somebody had to build the Mishkan, and Bezalel was the one to build the Mishkan. The second lesson. We all have talents, abilities, capabilities. And they are given to us predominantly to be used somehow in service of Hashem, in the service of Torah and the Jewish people, whatever it may be. And then you can use it for other things. That's the icing on the cake. But the main reason it was given was for this purpose. That's what it means, the name of something, the name of a person. So too, when it says that the heavens and earth were created for the names of the Jewish people, it means for their talents, abilities, and capabilities. And they should bring out those abilities, capabilities, and talents. And that really is what is called Geula, redemption. Redemption means taking what is there in the potential and actualizing it, bringing it out. The world has a lot of potential, but it's all potential. When that potential be brought out to perfection, the world will reach its geula, its redemption. Then Mashiach will come. Mashiach is when the world will reach its perfection. How does it reach perfection? By bringing the potential to the actual. And that's why there's another medrash that says that the redemption is hinted to in the names of the Jewish people. Because the redemption, when the Jewish people will bring out their potential, then the world will reach its potential. When each individual reach his perfection, that will make the world reach its perfection. And I always like to tell over a story I heard at a graduation. It's not a chazal, so don't look it up on the Bar Ilan. Won't find it there. It's just a story, but it brings out this point. There was once a man reading a magazine, and his little five-year-old was bothering him incessantly. And he couldn't make headway in the magazine at all. And he saw that one of the pages in the magazine was a map of the world. So he tore out the page, tore it into 25 little pieces, called over his child, and said, "This is a map of the world, it's a puzzle. Go put it together. And until you finish, don't come back." He figured he's going to have a few hours now of peace and quiet, because the child does not know what the picture of the map of the world looks like. The only way she'll be able to put it back together again is by matching the contours of the tears, and that's going to take her hours. So he figures a few hours now to get finished with the magazine. 15 minutes later, she comes back. "I finished. Right? The page is put back together. I finished the puzzle." He said, "It's impossible. So unless you knew what the picture of the world looked like, there's no way you could have put it back in 15 minutes. He says, "Come and see." Sure enough, on the glass top of a coffee table, the map of the world is put back together perfectly. The man says, "Hey, you must be a genius. You're 5 years old. You must know what the map of the world looks like, and that's how you put it together so quickly." He said, "No, it's very easy. You see, on the other side of the paper, there was a picture of a person. I just put the person together and the whole world fell into place." So that's you want to bring the world to perfection, every person perfect themselves, and the collective result will be that the world will also be perfect. And therefore, that's what it means. The Rabbanu Shalom, just like the stars, every star has its makeup, its chemical makeup, right, and its purpose in creation, and why with that star would be missing, the universe wouldn't be complete. That's what it means that God calls names to every star. Every star has its abilities, capabilities, talents, its qualities. And it's crucial to the perfection of the universe. So too, every Jew has his abilities, capabilities, and talents. Everyone's important. God counts each one. Everyone's necessary for the perfection of society and for the perfection of the world. That's the idea of Shmos. And therefore, the redemption is hinted to in the names of the Shvatim. And therefore, the book of names, Shmos, and the book of redemption go together. Exodus goes very together very, very nicely. Because where is the redemption? In the names of Klal Yisrael. So those two names of the book also go hand in hand. Okay. Torah tells us that a new king arose over Egypt who didn't know Yosef, and he put the Jewish people in bondage. What is the sentence immediately before that? Vatimale ha'aretz osam. Which gives us the following idea of when Klal Yisrael are at risk in Golus amongst the nations of the world, and when we can live amongst the nations of the world in relative peace and harmony. As long as the Jew remains separate from the way of life of the non-Jewish world around him, and not because the non-Jewish world are bad. They could be perfect. Perfect non-Jews who keep their seven mitzvahs and will get a share in the world to come. But that's not what we are supposed to be doing. The non-Jewish world have seven mitzvahs to keep. They're basically seven corresponding to the 7 days of the week, which is the physical, material world. A non-Jew's mission in this world is to build the physical infrastructure of the world, and in order to do that, he has to remain in harmony with the moral, natural world, and not corrupt the natural world, not distort it, and not destroy it. And those are the mitzvahs that he has. Those are the seven mitzvahs, says the Maral. Seven mitzvahs are basically the upkeep of the natural world. Shouldn't murder, shouldn't steal, shouldn't be immoral, right? And not be cruel and eat meat taken from a live animal and have a justice system, right, that he creates that is based on morality and what is just and right for people to be able to live together, right, and not serve idolatry. Those basically are the mitzvahs that a goy has, and if he fulfills his mitzvahs, he'll get a share in the world to come. But if a Jew lives a life like that, right, he's not fulfilling his mission in this world and will not get a share in the world to come. At least not the share that he's supposed to get. Because we have 613 mitzvahs that start with the mitzvah of Bris Milah on the eighth day. They have seven. We have to go beyond nature. We have to be holy, not just moral. There's a very big difference between morality and holiness. We also have to be moral. That's the basis. But we have to go beyond morality. I'll give you an example what that means, beyond morality. I'll give you two examples. There was a person named Feuerstein. I don't remember his first name. I think he's still alive. He lived outside of Boston. Aaron Feuerstein. You know him? Or you know of him? Okay. In any case, so he owned a textile mill and employed, I think, hundreds of people. It was a gigantic textile mill. And one night, his textile mill burnt to the ground. He had no more business. Morally, he could have told his workers, look, I don't have a business, so you're on your own. If I ever build back my business, I'd be happy to offer you jobs again, but right now, I have nothing, and that's it. And that was it. You know, nice knowing you, and that's it. But he didn't feel that he could do that. He was a religious Jew. And most of these workers were goyim. He kept them on the payroll I think for a few months he paid them their salaries until they could find other jobs. And then he kept them on the payroll for an extended amount of time in order that they shouldn't lose their pensions and they shouldn't lose their medical benefits. And he told them, look, right now I don't have work for you. You're going to have to go look for other places. But if I build back my business, you have guaranteed jobs. Just come back if you still want them. You have and I'm keeping you on the payroll so you don't lose your pensions, you don't lose your medical. That's holiness. And it was picked up by the whole world. Every media. He was a frum Jew. That was a Kiddush Hashem. That's holiness. I'll give you another example of holiness, a little bit not on such a grandiose way. I used to have an old uncle who eventually moved to Netanya and lived nearby here. He only lived here a few months until he was nifter. But he was an old uncle. He was the babysitter for my children when they were babies, when my daughters were growing up in America. And then we moved here, and he would come to visit us every year after Pesach till Shavuos, a few weeks. And at that time, we had in the house in Matityahu three bedrooms, and we had Kenai Nohara, 11 children. So one bedroom was for my wife and myself, one bedroom for our five daughters, and one bedroom for our six sons. We had triple bunk beds where the top guy used to hit his head on the ceiling when he got up in the morning. In any case, when my two oldest daughters became teenagers, okay, if you don't have teenage daughters, you won't understand what I'm talking about if you do. So they came to me and they said, Tati, we cannot share a room with our bratty little sisters. It is out of the question. So we need a bedroom for ourselves. And I had a study, another house, just for my Sfarim. I have about 30,000-40,000 Sfarim, and we had a house just for the Sfarim. But in that house, there were also two bedrooms. And my daughter said, look, the house is right across from ours. We want to move in, each of us, to one of those bedrooms, have our own room decorated the way we want, with the posters on the wall that we want, right? Not sharing it with our bratty little sisters, and we want permission to move into that house, each one having their own bedroom. And I gave them permission, and they moved into that. However, when my uncle came, there was no place for him to stay except in that study. And I told my daughters that because of the laws of Yichud, that you're not allowed to be alone, right, even with your uncle, right, his granduncle, so you're going to have to move out of there back with your bratty sisters at least for a few weeks until the uncle leaves. They said, Tati, this is absurd. Said, he's an old uncle who is our babysitter, right? He's old and sick. Are you suspicious that maybe he's going to try to do something, right, not nice to us? And we promise you, we have absolutely no interest in our old uncle. So nothing's going to happen. So we will both move into one bedroom there. He can occupy the other bedroom. The fact that we have to share a common bathroom, whatever, is no problem. And don't worry, nothing bad is going to happen, and we're staying where we are. I told him, you can't do that. There's laws of Yichud, and it's usher for you to be in that room, that house. And I told them a few different ideas why it wasn't absurd. But one of them I told them the following. You're right. Morally speaking, right, it's 100% moral for you to stay in one bedroom there, him in another one. Nothing's going to happen. But we're not goyim. And we have to be more than moral. And holiness means that you're not in a situation where there's even a taint of anything that could be not proper. Even if it's 100% moral. But it's not holy. And we're responsible to be holy. And that's not holiness. So you're going to have to move back, right? And for a few weeks, you'll be mekayim, the mitzvah of being holy, right? And it'll be a little uncomfortable. That's what life is all about. Okay. In any case, so that is what a Jew has to be. A Jew has to be holy, not just moral. And therefore, in order not to be influenced by the nations of the world, we have to be separated from them. The ideal separation is we have our own place. That was the purpose of Eretz Yisrael. Eretz Yisrael is a holy land with God's special connection to God. And we are a holy people with a special connection to God. And therefore the Medrash says that God measured every land. and he found no land more compatible to the Jewish people than Eretz Yisrael, and no people more compatible to Eretz Yisrael than the Jewish people. We fit each other like a glove. And therefore the ideal would be that we should be not isolated from the nations of the world, because we're supposed to be an influence on them. We're supposed to give them like a lighthouse to look up to. That this is a symbol of God. We're God's representatives to the world. So we're not isolated from the nations of the world. We're supposed to have connection with them, but insulated. We are separate, but together. But separate in an insulated way. And that's why the Midrash says that we're compared to oil, and the nations of the world are compared to water. Oil and water can coexist very nicely. If the oil floats on the water, there's a surface tension that separates it, and then the oil protects the water, and the water supports the oil. We can live amongst the nations of the world, again, it's ideally in Eretz Yisrael. But if we're forced not to live in Eretz Yisrael, we can live amongst the nations of the world as long as we remain insulated from them, like oil and water. But as soon as you try to mix the oil into the water, it can't happen. And eventually, the oil separates. And what separates it? The pressure of the water. So too, says Reb Chaim Volozhiner, the Jew has only two choices. Either he can make Kiddush, or the Goy will make Havdalah. Either he sanctifies himself and separates himself from the nations of the world by being sanctified, but if he doesn't want to sanctify himself, then history has shown that that's when the Goyim push us out. Whenever we try to assimilate into the culture around us, whether it was in Spain, or we'll see in Mitzrayim, or in Germany, where Jews tried to assimilate into the culture, then the Goyim pushed us out. It's a safety valve that the Rabban Shem set up in the world. The Medrash says that. The Medrash says, on the Pasuk, Am levodad yishkon. We are a nation that dwells apart. Again, insulated, not isolated from the world, but insulated. And the truth is, we can remain insulated in a positive way, and we read a Pasuk on Simchas Torah, in Vizos HaBracha, right? Vayishkon Yisrael betach badad. We will dwell in security, insulated from the world, if we choose to do it willingly. And then we read it on Simchas Torah, it's a yontif. But if we choose not to insulate ourselves and to try to assimilate into the cultures around us, then we're still going to remain badad. We're still going to remain insulated, whether we like it or not. If we try to mix the oil in the water, eventually the oil is going to separate, and the water is going to push it out. And then we're going to read another pasuk, Eicha Yashva Vadad. That pasuk we read on Tisha B'Av, sitting on the ground. So we have two choices. We can read the Badad in a Simcha Dika way, or we can read the Badad in a tragic way. That's the only two choices a Jew has, either Kiddush or Havdalah. One of the two. So that's what happened in Mitzrayim. As long as we remained in Goshen, separate, but amongst the Egyptians, but not assimilated into their culture, then the Egyptians respected us, and we lived very nicely together with them, like the oil on the water. But once, Vatimole Ha'aretz Osam, and the Medrash says euphemistically, we started going to the Egyptian circuses and the Egyptian theaters and wanted to assimilate into the culture of Mitzrayim, then Vayokam Melech Chadash. Then they made Havdalah. Then the king got scared. Right? You want to be Jews and live your own life, Gesundheit. You want to be better Egyptians than the Egyptians? Then we don't need you. And that's exactly how they started the slavery. It says, Paro declared that he needs some patriotic individuals in Mitzrayim to volunteer to build store cities. And Paro himself came to build. He said, we have a labor shortage. We need patriotic volunteers to work, and you'll be paid for being patriots. So the Egyptians ignored him. Whose are the major patriots of the Goyish lands? Jews. So the Jews came, and they started working for Paro. And one day, they saw that there's people behind them with whips, right, that are already taskmasters, right, they're not working anymore for free. So that's how Paro got them to be slaves. because he preyed on their desire to be bigger Egyptians than the Egyptians, to be more loyal Egyptians than the Egyptians were. And that's been our history, where in every place where Jews tried to assimilate into the culture where they were, that's where the biggest churban came. It was Germany, Spain, throughout history. And that's what happened in Egypt also. On the other hand, Paro himself, let's go on to a new part of the parsha. Vayokam melech chodesh al Mitzrayim, the Medrash says, Asher lo yodas Yosef. So the Gemara says, according to one opinion, this was the same Paro that was in the time of Yosef. And same Paro does not necessarily mean the same one actually, but it was from the same dynasty. According to the other opinion, it was a new dynasty, and that's more historically what happened. There was the Hyksos took over, and they came from the outside, and that's why they didn't know of Yosef, because they were a new dynasty from outside of Egypt that took over as a new king. But one opinion in the Gemara was that it was the same dynasty, same line of kings. How could he not know Yosef? He made himself like he didn't know. In other words, he was ungrateful. And the Gemara comments on that, Kol hakofe betovaso shobosar v'dam. A person who is ungrateful to human beings eventually will deny God. What's the connection? Being ungrateful to human beings. The only way that we can really recognize HaKadosh Baruch Hu is because we recognize the good things that He does. You can't recognize Him. He's invisible. We can't see Him. We can't understand Him. So we see His actions in the world. That's why we make a bracha, HaTova HaMeitiv. When good things happen, we attribute it to God, who is the ultimate good, and we trace it back to Him. So how do you recognize God in the world? By recognizing good in the world. So somebody who doesn't recognize good that a human being does for him, doesn't have the capability of recognizing and being grateful, eventually is going to not believe in God, because the only way that we can believe and recognize God is from the good that He does. And if people think that it's not, no, I'm not getting any good, I deserve it's coming to me, I'm endowed, right? It's not what's it called? It's something that's coming to me, right? Then what's it called? Then they'll never recognize the Rabbanu Shalom either. In order to be a makir tova, right, to have gratitude, it involves a few things. First of all, you have to recognize that there's good, that it's not coming to you. I remember, I think it was in Renana years ago, they had an election, and there was a big billboard, the picture of one of the candidates, and it says, vote for so-and-so, nagia lecha. Right? It's coming to you. Now, I don't know if that was put up by the opposition or by him, but in any case, whatever it was, like Magiali, most people think that when they're born with a guarantee that is tied to their big toe that says, you are guaranteed 100% satisfaction in this world, or you have a right to complain. And therefore, if things don't go 100%, people complain. When in truth, a person should feel that he's not guaranteed anything. God gave him life. He didn't promise him anything more than that. So if you have 1%, be happy for the 1%. Don't complain about the 99% you don't have. But most people are not like that. Most of us are not like that. And we, right, when it comes to human beings, we're like that. Right? A wife can slave in the kitchen, making a beautiful meal. Right? And what happens? Instead of getting praised for the beautiful meal, people complain, ah, it's too much pepper, it's not enough salt, how come there's not enough of this, or whatever. Instead of saying that, I'm happy I have something to eat, right? And if it's 99% good or 80% good, don't complain about the 20% that's not there, be happy with the 80% that's there. But most of us are not like that, unfortunately. So that's the first thing. Recognize that there's good, that it's not magia lecha, it's not coming to you, right? And the second thing is, recognize where that good's coming from. In other words, don't only attribute it to the immediate cause in front of you, but realize that if you trace things back to the source, you come back to God. It's like the baby who drinks milk from a bottle. So he thinks that he has to give thanks to the bottle. The bottle gives him milk. Gets a little bit older, he sees that the mother pours the milk from a container. He says, really, I've been giving my thanks to the wrong thing. It's not the bottle that gives milk, it's the containers that give milk. So I thank the container. gets a little bit older, he sees that the mother takes a container from the refrigerator. Ah, refrigerators are what give milk. Have to thank the refrigerator. Right, a little bit older, he sees that she buys the milk from the store, so the stores give milk. Gets a little bit older, goes out to the country, and sees the cows give milk. Then he realizes the cows didn't make themselves, right? The grass gives milk. And who made the grass? Eventually you come back to the Ribono Shel Olam. That's part of Hakaras HaTov. To realize what the last cause is, but what's the first cause? Trace it back to its source, and then you'll come back to God. So somebody who doesn't have the capacity to have gratitude to human beings eventually is going to deny God also, because our connection to God is through gratitude. And if you don't have gratitude to people, you're surely not going to have gratitude and recognize the Ribono Shel Olam. Ad kedei kach, that later on in the Sedra, it says, when the daughters of Yisro came, Moshe Rabbeinu chased away the shepherds that were preventing them from watering their sheep. So their father said, how'd you get back so fast? Usually every day you're pushed to the back of the line by these shepherds. So they said, Ish Mitzri Itzilanu, an Egyptian man saved us. So simple meaning is they thought Moshe Rabbeinu was Egyptian. And that's another medrash. But some say what it means, Ish Mitzri, does not mean Moshe. If Moshe told him the whole story, what he was doing there, because he killed an Egyptian, and he had to run away from Egypt, and that's why he came there, and because he came there, he was able to chase away the shepherds and give them the ability to water their sheep. So they said, you know who saved us? That Egyptian who was killed. Because if he wouldn't have been killed, Moshe wouldn't have been here. So they traced the gratitude back to its source, and gave credit to this poor Egyptian got killed, but Lamaisa, because of him, we ended up benefiting. So we have a Hakaras HaTov to him too. He didn't do anything except get killed. But he generated a good that came from him. We recognize that that also. Okay. Next, it says, let's go to the end of the Sedra and work backwards. Paro says the Jews are thinking too much of going free. This Moshe and Aaron are causing a revolution over here. Let's keep them busy. So he says, I'm not going to give you straw anymore. You're going to have to go and get straw, make your own mortar to build, make the bricks to build the cities that you're building as slaves. And you're going to have to keep up the same quota that you did before when I gave you straw. So you're going to have to work harder. And Paro wasn't stupid. If I was Paro, I would have done something else. Because what did Paro gain from this? They're making the same quota of bricks. I would have said, you're going to have to produce double the quota, right? And that way Paro will get double the amount of bricks, and they'll work double hard. But the way that he did it, right, he got nothing out of it, and they had to work double hard. Why didn't he do it the other way? The answer is, it says that Paro made them work avodas perech, backbreaking, debilitating labor. Now what is the definition of avodas perech? What makes work debilitating, and what makes work exhilarating? People work and they're exhilarated from work. Other when people are idle, right? It's not a good thing. People love to work sometimes. What's the difference between work that you like to do and work that's debilitating? There's a halacha that defines avodas perech. You're not allowed to work a Jewish slave avodas perech. So there has to be an explanation. What is avodas perech? Since it's a prohibition, you have to know what not to do. The definition of avodas perech is work without a goal. Just work to keep busy. It has no purpose. Purposeless work. That kind of work is debilitating. When a person works and he accomplishes, he feels exhilarated. I accomplished something. But if you work and you accomplish nothing, and it says that's what Paro made them do. He made them build Ore Miskinos. The simple meaning is store cities. But there's a Medrashic meaning, Miskenos. Miskain. They were pitiful cities. He made them build cities on sand that had no foundation. And eventually when they built the city, they fell in. And they had to build them again. They never accomplished anything. There's a story of a Soviet prisoner who was 10 years in a Soviet prison, and there was a handle in the wall of the prison, of his cell, that he was told that he has to rotate this handle 8 hours a day, and it's running a mill on the other side grinding grain for the sake of for Russia. And he's what's it called, contributing his work for the sake of the motherland. So he did this 8 hours a day for 10 years. He had to rotate this handle that he thought was running a mill on the other side of the wall. Finally, after 10 years, they let him free. And he said, before I go free, could you just show me the mill that I was running for the last 10 years? They all laughed. They took him to the other side of the wall, and he saw the handle is connected to nothing. For 10 years, he was turning a handle and accomplishing absolutely nothing. He said it was more painful to him to find out that he accomplished nothing in those 10 years than to be a prisoner for 10 years. That's Avodas Perach. Avodas Perach is work that you have no accomplishment. And that's why the word Perach, if you use the gematria called Esbash, Esbash means you take the first letter of the alphabet and you transpose it, you substitute it with the last letter. So a word that has Aleph now is tough. A word that has Shin is Beis, and so on. Okay? So in Esbash, Pei becomes Vav, and Resh becomes Gimel, and Chaf becomes Lamed. Vav, Gimel, Lamed. What does that mean? Absolutely nothing. But if you add up the numerical value, it's 39. What's 39? The 39 works of Shabbos. What is the antithesis of Avodas Perach? The 39 works of Shabbos, because those built the Mishkan. Those are work that had the greatest purpose possible, to build the Mishkan and bring God's presence. So if you want to know what the antithesis, the opposite of Perach is, it's the 39 works of Shabbos. So that's why Paro did what he did. If he would have given them a feeling they accomplished something, we're going to, what's it called, not get straw and produce double the quota, that wouldn't have been debilitating. They would have felt an accomplishment. So he said, no, I'm not going to give you straw, and you're going to have to make the same quota in double the time. You're going to work twice as hard and accomplish absolutely nothing more. That already is debilitating work, which will get their mind off of freedom and thinking about anything positive. I always like to add to this, L'cha'ora, women's work is Avodas Perach, because there's no lasting purpose to it, seemingly. You clean the house, right, especially if you have little kids, and within minutes, right, it's a disaster again. I remember when I was younger, and we used to have, you know, all these kids running around the house, and I'd leave the house in the morning, it looked like a hurricane hit it. I come back in the evening, and it looks the same way. So I said to my wife, what are you doing all day? She said, you gotta understand, right? I cleaned up the house perfectly, and the kids came home from school and turned it upside down again. And sometimes I believed her. So Lamaisa, what's it called? So there's no purpose. You work and you work. A woman makes a beautiful meal. They don't frame it and put it in a museum. People eat it. Gone. That's it. Finished. You have to make another meal. Right? She washes clothing. Right? What happens? People wear it and get dirty again. There's nothing lasting from it. So why isn't a woman's work Avodas Perach? The answer is very simple. If a woman thinks that her job is to clean clothing, clean the house, right, and make meals, then Enochanami is Avodas Perach. But if she realizes those are only the means to reach an end, the end is to create a family, to create a functioning home, and then you see the payers, you see the fruits of that over years and years, then that's a tremendous purpose. Then you see a lasting, eternal goal. But if you look and see that only the means are the end, then it's Avodas Perach. But if you know that those are means to reach an end, to create a family, to create a home, or whatever, for the future, then there's the all of those means reach to a tremendous goal. Yes?
When I was at Human Ecology at Cornell, people asked, what do you do? You teach cooking and sewing? I said, no, home and careers. It's not housekeeping, it's building homes.
Excellent. That's exactly the point. And a woman who feels like that, so it makes the work that she does exhilarating. But if she feels that her job is just to make meals or whatever, which is not a bad thing, but you don't see any lasting result from it, then it becomes very debilitating. Okay. Okay, it says that Paro then saw that he's not getting anywhere by trying to suppress the Jewish people by making them work hard. So he decided to take more drastic measures and have all the boys killed at birth, right? And he commanded the midwives to supervise the killing of the embryos before they were born to make sure they didn't make it alive. So nobody could really say it was an epidemic or something's wrong and Jewish children being born, stillborn. So it says, "Vatirena hamiyaldos esu elokim, velo also kashadibu alei melech mitzrayim, vatichayenes hayelodim." The midwives feared God, and therefore they didn't do what Paro said. So tells the Rosh Yeshiva asked, you have to fear God not to kill little babies? You have to be a human being, not an animal, not a monster. What does it attribute it to the fact that they feared God and therefore they didn't kill little babies? Even if you don't fear God, you could be an atheist, but you're a mensch. You don't kill little babies. Why is it attributed to the fear of God? And he said very simply, because if you don't fear God, right, then you can be a human being and kill little babies and justify it. The Nazis did it. They were refined people, listened to the opera and whatever, right? And they killed little babies. Why? Because they created a value system and a philosophy that said it's okay to kill little babies as long as they're Jewish or they're gypsies or whatever. And that did not conflict at all with their being human beings. You can be a human being. The only thing that stopped them from not justifying it and coming up with some kind of new philosophy was the fact that they feared God. That's the only thing that stops a person from killing little babies. Because without fear of God, you can create a new value system and justify killing little babies too. Next. It says that Moshe was born, and by Yigdal Hayelin, he grew up, and he was brought then to Bas Paro to raise him after he was weaned. And then the next sentence says, Vayigdal Moshe, he grew up again. So how many times did he grow up? So the Ramban says very simply, the first time was that he grew physically. And the second time was he matured. And he was called a Gadol. He was a great person. Now what made him great? So the Torah says, Vayetze Elecho Vayar B'Sivloso. He went out to his brothers and he saw and understood their suffering. And Rashi says, Nosan eino velibo lios meitzer aleihem. He put his heart and his mind to suffer along with them. Why is that called being great? Why is that greatness? Empathizing with somebody else. So Shimon Shkup asked the following question. He says that there's a tremendous conflict that a person has as a human being or as a Jew. On the one hand, we have to have self-concern. We have to be concerned about ourselves. That is a Torah mandate. You come first. You're number one. If you need tzedakah and you only have a certain amount of money and somebody else needs tzedakah, you come first. You take the money for yourself. If you're losing something and your father, mother, your Rebbe is losing something and you can only save one of them, right? You have a pet dog and your father has a pet dog. And they're both running away, and you can only save one. One of them's running into the street to get run over by a truck, and one of them you can save. Whose do you save? Yours. You come first. You have the right to save yours. Even your own life. You have a canteen of water. You can make it through the desert with it. If you share it with somebody else or give it to somebody else, he'll live and you'll die, or you'll both die. You take the canteen. It's yours. You come first. On the other hand, we are not allowed only to worry about ourselves. You have to worry about other people. So there's a tremendous conflict of worrying about yourself, self-concern, and concern about others. Many times there's a conflict. How do you resolve that conflict? So he says it's only a problem for somebody who considers himself from his toes to his head. And everybody else is everybody else. Then there's a conflict between me and everybody else. But some people are bigger than that. And they realize that their spouse is mamish part and parcel of them. Ishto kegufo bal ke ishto. When they're concerned about their spouse, they're not concerned about somebody else. It's self-concern. Except their self is two bodies. Some people are bigger than that, and they realize their children are an extension of them. When they're concerned about their children, they're not concerned about somebody else. They're concerned about themselves. Except themselves now extends to many bodies. Some people are bigger than that, and they realize that their extended family, uncles, aunts, cousins, are also part of them. Ach, atzmi u'besoriyot. Even Lovan understood that. And when they're concerned about their extended family, they're concerned about themselves. Some people, even bigger than that, they realize their neighborhood is all part of them. Their city, country, the whole world. So, a person who really is on a high level and considers everybody part of him, everything is self-concerned. Now it's only a question of priority. Which part of myself comes first? That's much less of a problem than me and them. Do I come first or them? When it's me and them, it's a very big conflict. When it's all me, except which part of me, that's less of a conflict. And he says, that's what the Mishnah says in Pirkei Avos. Im ein ani li mi li. If I will not be for myself, who's going to be for me? I have to worry about myself. Self-concern is important. But kishani li atzmi, when my me is just little me, from my toes to my head, more, that's not me. Me has to be including everybody. And my self-concern has to be everybody. So when Moshe Rabbeinu was able to empathize and feel the pain of his brethren as if it was his own, and for that you need two things, eino velibo, eyes and a heart. Eyes means intellect. First you have to really understand intellectually what the person really needs. Because if you don't have a brain, you sometimes may empathize with people and give them what is bad for them, but they think they need that. You have a drug addict who's asking you to give him money so he can go get drugs, right? That's not what's good for him. If you have a brain, so you know that you convince the person to go to what's it called, become drug free. But you won't feed his habit. Same thing goes with other things too. You know, somebody that's betting on whatever, you don't give him money to go and gamble. Now you try to wean him from the gambling. So you need a brain, but you also need a heart. Because if you just intellectually know what somebody else needs, you're not going to do anything about it. You need also an emotion. So you need both a combination between eyes and heart to be able to really empathize with somebody else. But that's a great person. That's a person who's not just his little small self. It's somebody who extends himself to include other people. That's called a gadol. That's called great. And I think the word ani represents that. What is my ani? Who am I? Aleph, the ani is spelled Aleph Nun Yud. The Aleph on the one side is the individual. That's me, person, individual. The Yud is a minion, is a tzibur, is the community. Right? That's a Yud, that's 10. Right, that's representative of a community. So I have me on one side and everybody else on the other side, the Yud. How do you combine that Aleph and the Yud and make it you with a Nun? The Nun is 50. There are 50 gates of wisdom and 50 gates of purity. If you have the right seichel, 50 gates of wisdom, and the right emotions, the right heart, 50 gates of purity, then you can take that Nun and connect the Aleph and the Yod and make that your Ani. Then that becomes you. And that's why it says, Vayigdal Moshe, when was he great? Right? When did he mature? Right? When Vayetzel Echo, Vayar B'Shivloso, when he went out to his brethren and empathized and felt what they were feeling.